Okay, so you're saying that the direction of evolution, the telos of the cosmos, is not random chance, but rather directionality?
Evolution has a direction, yes. A principle of order out of chaos, as it is commonly phrased. In other words, a drive toward greater depth. Chance is defeated, depth emerges. The intrinsic value of the cosmos increases with each unfolding.
So that's actually tenet five, which is the last tenet I want to discuss. In that tenet, you give various indicators of directionality in evolution, which I'll just list. Evolution has a broad and general tendency to move in the direction of increasing complexity, increasing differentiation and integration, increasing organization and structuration, increasing relative autonomy, and increasing telos.
Yes, those are some of the typically accepted, that is, scientifically accepted, directions of evolution. Well, this doesn't mean that regression and dissolution don't occur. They do. Dissolution is one of the four capacities of any holon. And it doesn't mean that every short-term development must follow those directions. As Michael Murphy says, evolution meanders more than it progresses. But over the long haul, evolution has a broad telos, a broad direction, which is particularly obvious with increasing differentiation, an atom to an amoeba to an ape. But all of those scientific descriptions can generally be summarized as the basic drive of evolution is to increase depth. This is the self-transcending drive of the cosmos, to go beyond what went before, and yet include what went before, and thus increase its own depth.
Now you also tie this in with consciousness, because you add, quote, the greater the depth of a holon, the greater its degree of consciousness, unquote.
Yes, consciousness and depth are synonymous. All holons have some degree of depth, however minor, because there is no bottom. And with evolution, depth becomes greater and greater. Consciousness becomes greater and greater. However much depth atoms have, molecules have more. And cells have more depth than molecules. And plants have more than cells, and primates more than plants. There is a spectrum of depth, a spectrum of consciousness. And evolution unfolds that spectrum. Consciousness unfolds more and more, realizes itself more and more, comes into manifestation more and more. Spirit, consciousness, depth. So many words for the same thing.
So since depth is everywhere, consciousness is everywhere?
Consciousness is simply what depth looks like from the inside, from within. So yes, depth is everywhere. Consciousness is everywhere. Spirit is everywhere. And as depth increases, consciousness increasingly awakens, spirit increasingly unfolds. To say that evolution produces greater depth is simply to say that it unfolds greater consciousness.
You use unfolds and enfolds.
Spirit is unfolding itself in each new transcendence, which it also enfolds into its own being at the new stage, transcends and includes. Brings forth and embraces, creates and loves. Eros and agape, unfolds and enfolds, different ways of saying the same thing. So we can summarize all this very simply. Because evolution goes beyond what went before, but because it must embrace what went before, then its very nature is to transcend and include, and thus it has an inherent directionality, a secret impulse toward increasing depth, increasing intrinsic value, increasing consciousness. Evolution is both God and goddess, transcendence and immanence. It is immanent in the process itself, woven into the very fabric of the cosmos. But it everywhere transcends its own productions and brings forth anew in every moment. And we are invited, I believe, to awaken as this process. The very spirit in us is invited to become self-conscious, or even, as some would say, super-conscious. Depth increases from subconscious to self-conscious to super-conscious, on the way to its own shocking recognition, utterly one with the radiant all, and we awaken as that oneness. What do you think? Is that crazy? Are the mystics and sages insane? Because they all tell variations on the same story, don't they? The story of awakening one morning and discovering that you are one with the all in a timeless and eternal and infinite fashion. Maybe the evolutionary sequence really is from matter to body to mind to soul to spirit, each transcending and including, each with a greater depth and greater consciousness and wider embrace. And in the highest reaches of evolution, maybe, just maybe, an individual's consciousness does indeed touch infinity, a total embrace of the entire cosmos, a cosmic consciousness that is spirit awakened to its own true nature. It's at least plausible. And tell me, is that story sung by mystics and sages the world over any crazier than the scientific materialism story, which is that the entire sequence is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying absolutely nothing? Listen very carefully. Just which of those two stories actually sounds totally insane? I'll tell you what I think. I think the sages are the growing tip of the secret impulse of evolution. I think they are the leading edge of the self-transcending drive that always goes beyond what went before. I think they embody the very drive of the cosmos towards greater depth and expanding consciousness. I think they are riding the edge of a light beam, racing toward a rendezvous with God. And I think they point to the same depth in you, and in me, and in all of us. I think they're plugged into the all, and the cosmos sings to their voices, and spirit shines through their eyes. And I think they disclose the face of tomorrow. They open us to the heart of our own destiny, which is also already right now in the timelessness of this very moment. And in that startling recognition, the voice of the sage becomes your voice. The eyes of the sage become your eyes. You speak with the tongues of angels and are alight with the fire of a realization that never dawns nor ceases. You recognize your own true face in the mirror of the cosmos itself. Our identity is indeed the all, and you're no longer part of that stream. You are that stream, with the all unfolding not around you, but in you. The stars no longer shine out there, but in here. Supernovas come into being within your heart, and the sun shines inside your awareness. Because you transcend all, you embrace all. There is no final whole here, only an endless process, and you are the opening or the clearing or the pure emptiness in which the entire process unfolds, ceaselessly, miraculously, everlastingly, lightly. The whole game is undone, this nightmare of evolution, and you're exactly where you were prior to the beginning of the whole show. With a sudden shock of the utterly obvious, you recognize your own original face, the face you had prior to the Big Bang, the face of utter emptiness that smiles as all creation and sings as the entire cosmos. And it is all undone in that primal glance, and all that is left is the smile and the reflection of the moon on a quiet pond late on a crystal clear night.
The superconscious is a little ahead of our story. We've covered evolution up to the emergence of human beings, the blossoming of the noosphere. You point out that each of the major stages of the evolution of human consciousness also follows the five tenets, so there's an overall continuity to evolution, from physiosphere to biosphere to noosphere.
Mm-hmm. And as evolution moves into the noosphere, then, based on the work of numerous researchers such as Gene Gebser, P.T. Sorokin, Robert Bella, Jürgen Habermas, Michel Foucault, Peter Berger, to name a few, we can outline the predominant world views of the various epochs of human development. These stages, these world views, may be summarized as archaic, magic, mythic, rational, and existential.
Now, you also correlate these with the major stages of technological economic development.
Yes, which are foraging, horticultural, agrarian, industrial, and informational.
So in each of those stages, you outline the types of economic production, the worldview, the modes of technology, the moral outlook, the legal codes, the types of religion.
And here is where we also begin to look at the status of men and women in each of those stages, because the relative status of men and women has varied tremendously across these stages, and the idea is to search for various factors that contributed to these changes.
which includes, of course, the emergence of feminism, that radical notion that human rights extend to women as well as men.
Well, yes. Based on the exciting work of recent feminist researchers such as Kay Martin, Barbara Voorhees, Joyce Nielsen, and Janet Chavitz, we can fairly well reconstruct the relative status of men and women in each of these five or so major evolutionary stages of human development. If we pull all of these sources together, we have the five or six major stages of techno-economic evolution, as outlined, for example, by Gerhard Lenski. The relative status of men and women in each of those stages, as outlined by Chavitz and Nielsen and others, and the correlation with worldviews, as outlined by Gebzer and Habermas. Using these sources, together with numerous others, we can reach some fairly sturdy conclusions about the relative status of men and women in each of these stages, and more important, we can isolate the factors that contributed to these differences in status.
Let's give a few examples here to see exactly what you mean.
Well, in foraging societies, also called hunting and gathering, the roles of men and women were sharply delineated and sharply separated. Men, indeed, did most of the hunting, and women most of the gathering and child-rearing. An astonishing 97% of foraging societies follow that pattern.
These societies emerged when?
Foraging societies first emerged somewhere between, 1,400,000 years ago. As Habermas points out, what separated the first humans from apes and hominids was not an economy or even tools, but rather the invention of the role of the father, what he calls the familialization of the male. By participating in both the productive hunt and the reproductive family, the father bridged these two value spheres and marked off the beginning point of specifically human evolution. Since the pregnant female did not participate in the hunt, this job fell to the male. But because there were few possessions, the wheel hadn't even been invented. There was little emphasis placed on either the male or female value sphere. Men's work was men's work, and women's work was women's, and never the twain shall cross. There were very strong taboos about that. But that didn't seem to be parlayed into a major difference in status. Because of this, these societies are held up as an example of social equality. But none of those folks, I think, would really enjoy the rigidity of the gender roles found in those foraging societies. Just the opposite, I think. I eulogize the original tribal societies for entirely different reasons. We are all the sons and daughters of tribes. The original tribes are literally our roots, our foundations, the basis of all that was to follow, the structure upon which all subsequent human evolution would be built, the crucial ground floor upon which so much history would have to rest. Today's existing tribes and today's nations and today's cultures and today's accomplishments all would trace their lineage in an unbroken fashion to the primal tribal holons upon which a human family tree was about to be built. And looking back on our ancestors in that light, I'm struck with awe and admiration for the astonishing creativity, the original breakthrough creativity that allowed humans to rise above a given nature and begin building a noosphere, the very process of which would bring heaven down to earth and exalt the earth to heaven, the very process of which would eventually bind all peoples of the world together in, if you will, one global tribe. But in order for that to occur, the original tribes had to find a way to transcend their isolated tribal kinship lineages. They had to find a way to go trans-tribal, and agriculture, not hunting, provided the means for this new transcendence.
So foraging eventually gave way to agriculture. You point out that there are two very different types of farming cultures, horticultural and agrarian.
Yes, horticultural is based on a hoe or simple digging stick. Agrarian is based on a heavy animal-drawn plow.
That sounds like a really fine point.
Well, it's actually quite momentous. A digging stick or simple hoe can be used quite easily by a pregnant woman, and thus mothers were as capable as fathers of doing horticulture, which they did. In fact, about 80% of the foodstuffs in these societies were produced by women. The men still went off and hunted. Small surprise, then, that about one-third of these societies have female-only deities, and about one-third have male and female deities, and women's status in such societies was roughly equal with men's, although their roles were still, of course, sharply separated.
Now, these were matriarchal societies?
Well, matrifocal. Matriarchal strictly means mother-ruled or mother-dominant. Rather, these societies were more equalitarian, with roughly equal status between men and women. And many such societies did indeed trace ancestry through the mother, and in other ways have a matrifocal arrangement. As I said, about one-third of these societies had female-only deities, particularly the Great Mother in her various guises. And conversely, virtually every known Great Mother society is horticultural. Almost any place you see the Great Mother religion, you know there's a horticultural background. And this began roughly around 10,000 BCE in both the East and the West.
This period tends to be romanticized by those who would hold up these matrifocal societies as an example for modern times, huh?
Well, yes, these societies and a few maritime ones.
Because they lived in harmony with the seasonal currents of nature, and in other ways were also ecologically oriented.
Yes, and average life expectancy, according to Lenski's research, was about 25 years, which is pretty natural as well. You see, it's the same problem as with eulogizing the previous foraging tribes because they were supposed to be in touch with unadulterated nature. But what is unadulterated nature? Some claim that these early farming societies were living with the seasonal currents of nature, in touch with the land, which was pure nature, not interfered with by humans. Yet others condemn farming of any sort as the first rape of nature, because you're no longer just gathering what nature offers. You're planting, you are artificially interfering with nature, you're digging into nature and scarring her face with farming technology. You're starting to rape the land. The heaven of the ecofeminists is the beginning of hell, according to others.
It seems you don't eulogize either foraging or horticultural societies.
Well, evolution keeps moving, yes? Who are you to point out to one period and say everything past that period was a colossal error, a heinous crime? According to whom, exactly? If we really are in the hands of the Great Spirit or the Great Mother, do we really think she doesn't know what she's doing? Tell you the truth, that seems like arrogance to me. In any event, we're three or four major technological epochs down the line, and I doubt evolution will run backward for us.
Now, you often refer to this as the dialectic of progress.
Yes. The idea is that every stage of evolution eventually runs into its own inherent limitations, and these may act as triggers for the self-transcending drive. The inherent limitations create a type of turmoil, even chaos, and the system either breaks down, self-dissolution, or escapes this chaos by evolving to a higher degree of order, self-transcendence, so-called order out of chaos. This new and higher order escapes the limitations of its predecessor, but then introduces its own limitations and problems that cannot be solved on its own level. In other words, there's a price to be paid for every evolutionary step forward. Old problems are solved or diffused only to introduce new and sometimes more complex difficulties. But the retrogressive romantics simply take the problems of the subsequent level and compare them with the accomplishments of the previous level, and thus claim everything has gone downhill beyond their favorite epoch. I think we all want to honor and acknowledge the many great accomplishments of past cultures the world over, and attempt to retain and incorporate as much of their wisdom as we can. But the train, for better or worse, is in motion, and has been from day one. And trying to drive by looking only in the rearview mirror is likely to cause even worse accidents.
You point out that our epoch, too, will only pass.
No epoch is finally privileged. The process continues. And spirit is found in the process itself, not in any particular epoch or time or place.
Okay, so to recap with respect to horticultural societies and the eventual shift to agrarian, even though both are farming, this shift from hoe to plow was actually momentous.
Quite extraordinary. Where a digging stick can easily be handled by a woman who's pregnant, an animal-drawn plow cannot. As Joyce Nielsen and Janet Chavitz have pointed out, women who attempt to do so suffer significantly higher rates of miscarriage. In other words, it was to women's Darwinian advantage not to plow. And thus, with the introduction of the plow, a massive, absolutely massive shift in culture began. First, virtually all of the foodstuffs were now produced solely by men. What we really learn from these various societies is that when the sexes are heavily polarized, that is, when their value spheres are sharply divided and compartmentalized, then both sexes suffer horribly.
Which is what happened with the patriarchy.
The polarization of the sexes, yes. Agrarian societies have the most highly sexually polarized structure of any known societal type, along with herding. This was not a plot, but was simply the best that these societies could do under the technological form of their organization at that time. Thus, when men began to be virtually the sole producers of foodstuffs, then, no surprise, the deity figures in these cultures switched from female-oriented to almost exclusively male-oriented. Over 90% of agrarian societies, wherever they appear, have solely male primary deities.
In your book, Sex, Ecology, and Spirituality, you say, quote, where females work the field with a hoe, God is a woman. And where males work the field with a plow, God is a man.
Oh, well, that's a quick summary, yes. God and goddess might have more profound and more transpersonal meanings, which we can talk about later. But for the average mode of human consciousness at that time, those mythic images usually represented much more prosaic realities. They represented, in many cases, the bedrock techno-economic realities of the given society.
So where God is a man, this is one of the meanings of patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. And patriarchy, father rule, is correctly named. And here we briefly touch base with Marx. Because of the social relations that began to organize themselves around the basic forces of production, in this case the plow, men then began to dominate the public sphere of government, education, religion, politics. And women dominated the private sphere of family, hearth, home. This division is often referred to as male production and female reproduction. Agrarian societies began to arise around 4000 to 2000 BCE in both East and West, and this was the dominant mode of production until the Industrial Revolution. Just as far-reaching was the fact that advanced farming created a massive surplus in foodstuffs, and this freed a great number of men to pursue tasks other than food gathering and food creating, and now on a very large scale. That is, farming technology freed some men from production, but women were still largely tied to reproduction. This allowed a series of highly specialized classes to arise, men that could devote their time not just to subsistence endeavors, but to extended cultural endeavors. Mathematics was invented, writing was invented, metallurgy, and specialized warfare. And likewise, with agrarian farming, a class of individuals would be free to ponder their own existence, and thus, with these great agrarian cultures, came the first sustained contemplative endeavors, endeavors that no longer located spirit merely in the biosphere, out there, magical, foraging to early horticultural, and not merely in the mythic heavens up there, mythology, late horticultural to early agrarian, but rather located spirit in here, through the door of deep subjectivity, the door of interior awareness, the door of meditation and contemplation.
I want to come back to that issue of male and female spirituality because it involves what you call ascending and descending spirituality, or God and goddess spirituality, and how we might balance these two approaches. But first, to finish with agrarian and the shift to industrial, how does this relate to modernity?
Modernity usually means the events that were set in motion with the Enlightenment, from Descartes to Locke to Kant, and the concomitant technical developments which moved from feudal agrarian with a mythic worldview to industrialization and a rational worldview. And post-modernity usually means, in the broadest sense, the whole sweep of post-Enlightenment developments, which also includes post-industrial developments.
So we're at the beginning of modernity, the shift from agrarian to industrialization, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Industrialization, for all of its horrors and all of its nightmarish secondary effects, was first and foremost a technological means to secure subsistence not from human muscle working on nature, but from machine power working on nature. As long as agrarian societies demanded physical human labor for subsistence, plowing, those societies inevitably and unavoidably placed a premium on male physical strength and mobility. No known agrarian society has anything even vaguely resembling women's rights. But within a century of industrialization, which removed the emphasis on male physical strength and replaced it with gender-neutral engines, the women's movement emerged for the first time in history on any sort of large scale. Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Women was written in 1792. It is the first major feminist treatise anywhere in history. It's not that all of a sudden women became smart and strong and determined after a million years of oppression. It's that the social structures had evolved, for the first time in history, to a point that physical strength did not overwhelmingly determine power and culture. Biology was no longer destiny when it came to gender roles. Within a mere few centuries, a blink in evolutionary time, women had acted with lightning speed to secure legal rights to own property, to vote, and to be their own persons, that is, to have a property in their own selves.
The data seem to support this view?
The empirical evidence presented by the feminist researchers that I mentioned indicates that, as Chavitz puts it, the status of women in late industrial societies is higher than in any other surplus-producing society in history, including the horticultural. People who vocally condemn late industrial and informational society and eulogize great mother horticultural societies seem to be out of touch with a good deal of evidence, or they very selectively choose a few nice items about yesterday and ignore the rest of yesterday's nightmare, and compare that Eden with nothing but the very worst of modernity. This is a very suspect endeavor. None of which means further gains aren't required in today's world for both men and women. Remember, the polarization of the sexes is brutally hard on each. Men and women both need to be liberated from the horrendous constraints of agrarian polarization. Industrialization began this liberation, began to expand gender roles beyond biological givens, transcend and include. But we need to continue developing this freedom and transcendence.
For example?
Well, for example, when men are no longer automatically expected to be the primary producers and the primary defenders, we might see the average life expectancy of men rise a little bit more toward the female level, and see women less restricted to roles involving merely reproduction or home and hearth. The brutalities were equal and shared, so the liberation will be equally shared and beneficial, I think.
Now, what about industrialization and the eco-crisis? Surely that's one of the major downsides of modernity, of this dialectic of progress.
Indeed. But it's an extremely tricky situation. The primary cause of any ecological devastation is simple ignorance. It's only with scientific knowledge of the biosphere, of the precise ways in which all holons in the biosphere are interrelated, including the biological holons of the human being, it is only with that knowledge that men and women can actually attune their actions with the biosphere. A simple or sacred respect for nature will not do. A sacred outlook on nature did not prevent numerous tribes from despoiling the environment out of simple and innocent ignorance. Rosak points out that it is modern science, and modern science alone, the ecological sciences and system sciences, for example, that can directly show us how and why our actions are corroding the biosphere. If the primal tribes knew that by cut and burn they would ruin their habitat and endanger their own lives, if they actually knew that with a scientific certainty, then they would have thought about it before they began their biodestruction. But ignorance is ignorance. Whether innocent or greedy, sacred or profane, ignorance destroys the biosphere.
But the means have changed.
Ah, that's the second point, indeed. Ignorance, backed by foraging technology, is capable of inflicting limited damage. You can only do so much damage to the biosphere with a bow and arrow. An atomic bomb is something else. The same ignorance, backed by industry, is capable of killing the entire world. So we have to separate those two issues, the ignorance and the means of inflicting that ignorance, because with modernity and science we have, for the first time in history, a way to overcome our ignorance at precisely the same time we have created the means to make this ignorance absolutely genocidal on a global scale.
So it's good news and bad news.
The predicament of modernity, yes. Finally, we know better. At the same time, if we don't act on this knowledge, then finally we all die. Brings new meaning to the Confucian curse, "May you live in interesting times."
This concludes Session 1 of A Brief History of Everything by Ken Wilber. Our program continues with Session 2.